So, if you will, turn with me to this week's Torah portion, and this one's actually pretty short. It's basically just one chapter. It begins and almost ends in the book of Leviticus, Vayikra, chapter 25. So you can turn to 25, and it begins right at verse 1 there, and it says this, as most of these do, it says, "And Yahuwah spoke unto Moshe, and what did he say?" Well, where did he say it? Actually, is the way to start this time. He spoke unto Moshe, Bahar Sinai, in Har, Oh, that's the word means mountain, or mount. So, in Mount Sinai. And he said the following. Here are the words in red. "Speak unto the children of Israel, say to them, when you come into the land." So let's pause right there, because on that score, what we're going to see here is a bit different. These are clearly... laid out this way, these are mitzvot, commandments that have to do with when you get into the land, and they're not there yet. And if you think about it, there are a lot of things here that they can't do until they're in the land. Now, here's the question that always gets asked. We'll address it right up front. Do they apply to us? And I will point this out. There are a lot of things in the Torah that are conditional. I'm always very fond of pointing out, Yeshua said, I'm not going to change one yoder tittle, not the smallest part, not nothing, so long as heaven and earth still exist. And that is true. The things that he laid down for us are still true. This is still true. The question is simply, since we're not in the land, can we do these things? And the answer would seem to be no. Now, there are some elements to this that I'm going to suggest have value. That's a really good reason for studying them. But to the extent that when you come into the land isn't true, the conditional, whether we like it or not, doesn't apply. We've been kicked out of the land, exiled for cause. So we'll bear that in mind. We'll go through this. What I think is particularly interesting about this portion, and I'll talk about some of this up front, some of it as we go through, is, it's another one of these examples of something that if we were to pay attention to it, if we'd paid attention, 2,000 years ago, more than that at this point, we wouldn't have been kicked out to begin with. And B, of course, there is a lot of really good advice that if we'll stop and think about and study what's here, it will give us some real insight, I suggest, into where we are today as well, particularly with this question of land ownership. And I saw a comment online a little while ago about people not owning houses, or can they own houses and have mortgages? Well, if you have a mortgage, clearly you don't own it. But guess what? I'm going to contend further that unlike what the law once was in the United States and indeed most of the world, when there was a time that people could actually, at least according to the law of the land, own the land, even if the Torah might have a slightly different understanding, that's no longer true. Nowadays, the true landowner sends a property rent notice. They call it property tax or other things in different places. But it's the true landowner that will kick those off that think they own the land if they don't pay the rent. There's a message there, too. So let's go through it. When you come into the land, which I give you. And oh, right there, I think we're starting to see part of the message. It's his land, and he gives it to who he will. And again, that's part of the reason. There are conditions associated with his land too. Keep my commandments. Honor my Sabbaths. Don't worship other gods. And when we, those who were alive at that point, violated his commandments, just as he said, we got kicked out and we're still indeed in exile. Okay, see, here's a question on the screen. I'm not sure that the question makes sense. Okay, here we go. Why in the Messianic age are Gentiles required to keep the feast outside the land of Israel? Well, because they're his feasts, I guess. And he is going to basically say, look, I gave you all a chance for a long, long time to figure this out. That's kind of the way I read it. I'm not going to try to speak for him. And I think that's the key thing here. It's enough for me to understand I'm not wild about the term Gentiles simply because most of us, whether we know it or not, are of the tribes, even if we are in exile. And Gentiles, if we look at the etymology of the word, really has a greater implication of paganism. And in the context of why is it that the pagans outside the land will be required to keep the feast, maybe that helps to answer the question. when we get back into the land, there'll be some other things that we're going to do as well, and they kind of hinge on some of the things we're seeing here. So it says, when you come into the land, which I give you, then not only will you be keeping the Sabbaths of days, set apart times, set apart people, his Moedim, but also the land will also keep a Sabbath. And it's going to be, in this case, 7 years in the pattern. 6 years, you sow your fields. In the seventh year, it's a Sabbath of rest for the land, a Sabbath unto Yahuwah. You don't do any of the things that you did those other 6 years, prune your vineyard, gather in your produce, nor do you sow your field. It is the Shemitah year. Most of you have probably heard that term. Sometimes you'll see it referred to in the English as a sabbatical year. That's the same root word there, repeating pattern of sevens. There is this observation, things which grow of themselves. Remember, it's his land. If the plants want to replant themselves and grow, that's fine. The Sabbath produce of the land is food for you. You just don't reap it in the conventional fashion. It's also food for your servant, your maid, your hired servant, and the settler that sojourns with you, and for your cattle and all the beasts in your land. All this increase is for food. Now, there's another pattern that is another pattern of seven times seven as well. You number seven Sabbaths of years. There comes the seven times seven. And there are unto you these days of seven Sabbaths of years, 49 years. Then you make a proclamation, a teruah, with the blast of the shofar on the 10th day of the 7th month, which we know as the day of atonement, Yom Kippur. You make that proclamation with the horn throughout your land. And here comes a set of words that some of you may recognize. They're inscribed famously, at least they used to be famous, no longer, I guess, in post-constitutional America, on the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia. They say, proclaim liberty throughout the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. This is the year that in the Hebrew is called Yovel. The English word is similar. We take the name from that, Jubilee. Every man is to return to his possession, every man unto his own family, and this is the year when literally land that may have been sold, cannot be sold in perpetuity in most cases, will return to the house, to the family, to the tribe, the lineage that it started out in. That Jubilee year, that Yovel year, is the 50th year. In that year you do not sow, nor do you reap that which grows of itself in it, nor do you gather the grapes of the undressed vines. It is a Yovel. It is to be truly set apart. You can eat the increase out of the field. And in this Yovel year, every man returns to his possession. If you buy something from your neighbor or from your neighbor's hand, you're not to wrong one another. And according to the number of years after the Jubilee, you buy of your neighbor, and according to the number of years of crops, he will sell unto you. What is this saying? In the English, we would call this discounting, or essentially taking a look at how many years are yet to go until the time is that the land is going to return. It's a little bit like the concept of depreciation. The time up until the Jubilee year, the Yovel year, is a depreciable asset. So if there's only a few years left until the Jubilee, and you're looking to try to raise some money, and you think, okay, I need to sell this land, knowing full well that what you're really selling is kind of a short-term rent on the land, because it's going to go back to its true owner, well, at least to its earthly owner, then you're not going to get as much for it as if there were still 30 or 40 years to go until the next Yovel. So that's what it says in these next few verses. According to the multitude of years, you increase the price, or the fewness of years, you decrease it. In other words, you depreciate the price literally, linearly, based on the number of years. Do not wrong one another, but fear Elohim, for I am Ani Yahuwah Elohim. Do, therefore, my statutes, my ordinances, and you will dwell in the land in safety. And the land will yield her fruit, her increase, and you will have enough. You'll eat until you are literally satisfied and dwell in safety. Now, if you start saying things like, what are we going to eat in this seventh year? How can we possibly eat if we're not going to sow nor gather in our increase? I guess I'll ask it as a question. Who do you trust? And this, by the way, is kind of where I'm headed in this portion. I'll probably elaborate a bit more on this tomorrow, because I think what is so fascinating, the reason why, even though we're not in the land and we don't, we cannot do, at least, not in this sense, a Shemitah or a sabbatical year or the Yovel, there is so much about this that is really, really instructive to us. Nowadays, what do we say in America, or in Britain, or in Canada, or in South America? Well, the Almighty State will provide. He owns the land, right? If you don't pay your taxes, he comes and takes the land, so I guess he's the true owner. In a fascist state or in a communist state, well, we see large, widespread famine is kind of a hallmark of those things, both in Russia and in China, and I think we're heading there in America as well. What are we going to eat in these years? Well, the corporate factory farms will take care of it. The Almighty State will take care of it. Forget God. And that really seems to be the attitude. In other words, I've got a note in my margin here about verse 20. Well, by the way, we're at chapter 25 of Leviticus, verse 20, approximately. The sages will say this particular verse is another indicator of the divine ownership of this land, and the divine authorship of this book. Because in both cases, what we're talking about here is a degree of trust that, quite frankly, we don't see anymore. And I guess it's probably a large part of why it was that people of Israel were kicked out, and of Judah. What are we going to eat in the seventh year? Oh, we can't sow, we can't gather in our increase. Whoa, what are we going to do? How can we possibly get by? Answer? Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh says, I'll command my blessing upon you in the sixth year, and it'll bring enough produce forth for 3 full years. You got nothing to worry about if you will just trust in me. You'll sow in the eighth year. You can eat the produce that year, but remember, it takes a while for crops to grow. So essentially what he's saying is it's going to take 3 full years here that you're going to have to rely on me in the ninth year. Up until then, you can eat the old store. And really, that's a fascinating thing. And it kind of goes back to the heart of this. I said I was going to emphasize this, and here's one of those places where we are. Who owns the land? Well, it's my land. He tells us that over and over again. My land, says Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. I'm going to give it to you. I'll give it to whom I please. The whole point of the Exodus and bringing the people into the land of Canaan was the land's going to vomit out its inhabitants because these people have done all this stuff that I don't like. They have worshipped other gods before me. They've literally polluted the land with their abominations, and the land will vomit them out. And here you are. I'm going to bring you into this land, a land flowing with milk and honey, because Ani Yahuwah. And all I ask is that you honor my Sabbaths and keep my commandments and do the things I'm telling you to do. They're not too hard for you. Deuteronomy 30 makes that clear. And if you will do these things, blessing will literally overtake you. And here, once every 7 years, you're going to get a dramatic proof of that, if you'll just simply trust in me. Land, by the way, verse 23, is not to be sold in perpetuity. It's mine. That's what we're emphasizing. You are the ones who are the strangers, the sojourners, the settlers with me. And in all the land of your possession, you're to grant a redemption of the land. Why? Because it's really my land, you possess it, and I'm the one that writes the rules. It really is that simple. That's part of the reason why, if you notice, especially of late, I have railed against, the pagan fish hat guy, the Pope Satan, who essentially is saying, no, we rewrite the rules. You can't trust in the God of the Bible. We haven't talked about him or his word for a long, long time. We'll tell you what you should know and what you should do. The Almighty State does the same thing. God's not welcome in the schools. We don't talk about any of that kind of stuff. You want to trust in something? You want your entitlements? Big Brother provides those. This God of the Bible isn't welcome. And we own the land. Hey, when we forget who owns the land, we tend to do other things. We forget what the founders knew and once wrote down for us in genuine print. We hold certain truths to be self-evident. That we have these rights. Rights to the land, indeed, that come from our Creator. And there's no earthly government that has the power to override that. We've forgotten that. We've forgotten so many of these things. We got kicked out of the land for cause 2,700 years ago. And now we're seeing similar things again. And this this next set of verses is going to help to emphasize that. Now, this one is one of those things that when I go through it, I talk about it in the context of the Great Reset Button. And that's literally among the things that we see here. It's kind of a fascinating understanding. I remember long before I ever understood Torah, I understood this from Economics 101. And a simple look at actuarial tables and compound interest tables will show you this. We'll come back to that concept in just a second. Because it introduces us to it this way. If your brother is a poor dude, he has waxen poor, he sells some of his possession, some of his land, presumably, and then he has a near kin. That guy, that near kin, can redeem the thing which his brother has sold. And if there's no one that's of near kin to redeem it, and he's waxen rich himself, then later he is allowed to redeem it. That's an important thing. You're not allowed to say to him, oh, you sold me this stuff, I'm keeping it, I really like this land. No, it really wasn't yours. You just bought a lease on it for a while. Verse 27 tells you how it's supposed to work. Count the years from the sale and restore the discounted time series to the man who sold it. In other words, you're going to pay back the guy that bought the short-term lease up until the time of the next jubilee, and he returns the money, and the buyer returns the deed, the possession, the land. But if the fellow who we're talking about here doesn't have enough means to get it back for himself, that which has been sold remains in the hands of the fellow that bought it up until the year of the jubilee. And at the year of the jubilee, it goes out anyway, returning to the one who had it before. Now this, it says in the next couple of verses, does not apply to the dwellings of houses and so forth that are in a walled city. When it comes to the walled city, you got a year to redeem it. For a whole year, the right of redemption exists. But if it's not done within that first year, then in the case of the walled city specifically, now it's a perpetual thing. Doesn't go out in the jubilee. When we're talking about villages, though, that don't have a wall around them, well, they're kind of like the fields in the country. And they do, the jubilee does, in other words, apply to them. When it comes to the Levites, the houses and cities of their position, well, the Levites have a perpetual right of redemption. Levites always have been a set-apart people with a set-apart task before Yahuwah. And then basically it just emphasizes that. Fields of the open land may not be sold. That is their perpetual possession. If a brother is waxen poor, you're to help him out, it says. As a stranger and a settler, he is to live with you. Do not take interest of him or increase, but fear Yahuwah, so that your brother can live with you. Now, the question, of course, is, and we'll come back to this, who is my brother, right? Is this talking specifically just sons of the same mother and or father? Don't give him money upon interest, nor give him victuals for increase. There's a lot of argument, as you might suspect, about this, particularly among people that don't want somebody to be their brother that they're afraid is going to come and live with them. But in any case, Ani Yahuwah Elohim, I'm the one who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you this land of Canaan, he says, to be your God. If your brother is really poor, he's even poorer than we were just talking about, and now he can sell himself unto you. You're not to make him truly a bondservant. As a hired servant or a settler, he can be with you. And then in this case, he serves up until the year of the Jubilee, and then he goes out, he and his children with him, and returns to his own family and to his possession, the land of his fathers. For all of these, it says, are my servants that I brought out of the land of Egypt. They are not to be sold as bondmen, and you're not to rule over them with rigor. But fear Yahuwah. As for your bondmen, bondmaids that you can have, these are folks from the nations that are around you. You can buy them, and they can literally be your possession. Interesting. If a stranger who is a settler with you waxes rich, and now he sees your brother is waxing poor, and your brother ends up selling himself to that stranger, or the offshoot of that stranger's family, after he's sold, he, here in the land, can be redeemed. One of his brothers can redeem him, or his uncle's son, his cousin, any that is near of kin to him or his family can redeem him. Or if he ends up with a little cash on hand himself, he can redeem himself. And then it tells us again, the idea is you redeem him according to this declining time series. You depreciate the amount of time that's left up until the Jubilee. Lots of years more, less years fewer. As a hired servant year by year to be with him, you do not, this is interesting, by the way, we're heading down towards the end of the portion. Year by year, it is to be with him. Don't rule with rigor over him in your sight. That seems like an extraneous little bit of verbiage there, doesn't it? You're just told, don't rule over him with rigor. Okay, what does it mean, in your sight? This is one of those places where Rashi, the Hebrew scholar, and as some of you know, I will preface this, I tend to think Rashi has a better grasp of the language than I do. So while I don't regard what he says as gospel, I do think it's good educational stuff. And he points out, when you see words like this, that you go, what does that mean? It's time to take a little closer look. And he suggests that what this means, in your sight, is that if you do see it, hey, you're not supposed to do it yourself. You ought to know better. But if you see it, why would it make this special point? Well, evidently, it's because you, in fact, have a duty to speak up and to say something, to intervene. And I find that that is a pretty consistent understanding with Torah. There are times when we're told, don't keep silent. We're supposed to positively do the right thing. All right, when somebody is not redeemed by any of these means, well, as it has told us before, it tells us again in conclusion, on the year of the Jubilee, he goes out along with his children. Because, says, unto me are the B'nai Israel, their servants, they're mine, just like the land is. I brought them forth out of the land of Egypt, ani Yahuwah Elohechem, and furthermore, the land is mine, I am giving it to whom I choose. He gave it to the people, the descendants, the tribes of Israel. He told them, there are conditions associated with this. You keep my land, you're going to be blessed beyond measure. I'm sorry, keep my commandments in the land, you'll be blessed beyond measure. You fail to do that. You know, as Bill Cosby would have said years ago, I brought you into this world, I can take you back out of it. I brought you into this land, I'll take you out of it. And indeed he did. Verse 26 was out of place. Well, it is the first verse of the next chapter. Why is this here? I think it's because it's the capstone. You're to make no idols, nor rear up a graven image or a pillar, nor place any figured stone in your land, to bow down to it for Ani Yahuwah Elohechem. He keeps coming back to that. This is my land. You're my people. I am to be your Elohim. I brought you out. I've blessed you. If you fail to do the simple things that I'm telling you to do, and especially if you raise up these idols, if you worship other gods before me, I brought you in, I can take you back out. You shall keep my Sabbaths, reverence my set-apart places, my sanctuary, my holy set-apart places, Ani Yahuwah. Now, at this point, I want to pause. Let's just kind of summarize all of this, because there's some really interesting stuff here. And I think what I'm going to do is spend a lot more time talking about some of the specifics tomorrow. In just a couple minutes, we will talk a little bit about the news this evening. And I do think there are more than casual similarities between what's going on and what this Torah portion is telling us. We got people that today in the United States, especially, well, the whole stinking world, don't have a clue what honest weights and measures are. They don't know what the word capitalism means. They certainly don't understand free markets. And I contend they don't understand that you cannot have these kinds of things. You can't have free exchange. You can't buy or sell or rent or lease. You can't do any of this stuff with dishonest weights and measures. How can you have honest contracts when you're trading things that aren't even real, that aren't honest to begin with? So let's connect a couple of dots here. I mentioned this idea about, well, and it's throughout the scripture, but especially in here. You don't take interest of your brother. We know that it's okay, at least it has been done, that interest will be taken from people who are foreigners, strangers, sojourners. And I mentioned also this idea of compound interest and what happens. If you go look at a table or a chart of compound interest, you see that it grows exponentially. And what that means is that after about 40 years, it really starts to get a leg on. By 50 years, debt can expand, incredibly. 60 years, 70 years. In other words, over the time of about a human lifetime, debt becomes literally out of control. So isn't it interesting then that in his word, the creator of the universe put this mechanism, the Yovel, the Jubilee, that literally says every 50 years, I'm going to pull the reset button. The debts disappear. It's kind of like saying, I understand how the math works. I created you. I created the world. I understand how human nature works as well. I understand that if you, in fact, do the things that I'm telling you not to do, or even if you do the things that I am giving you a little bit of leeway to do, but with the wrong attitude, it can literally snowball and cause problems beyond your imagination. Well, they're not beyond our imagination anymore. We see them. What were once hundreds of dollars of debt became millions and then billions of dollars debt. Now the number they're talking is quadrillions of derivatives, exposure, and so forth. We haven't had a jubilee in a long time. Turns out that what happens naturally is if you don't get a jubilee about every 50 years, you get a Great Depression about every 70 or 80. And I've said for the longest time, in order for the Great Depression to happen, or as we're seeing now to happen again, everybody with the good sense to know better has to die. And then things explode because people don't realize that debt literally destroys things. But we're seeing it. And we're seeing what happens when people think they own things that in fact are his. And the difference is in the attitude. And that's kind of how I want to wrap all of this up. Like I said, we'll spend some more time talking about this in detail here. But it is fascinating to me to see what the reset button was supposed to do. And to see on the other hand, what happens when the reset button doesn't get pulled. And furthermore, this whole attitude thing. Let's go back and we'll talk about what was in this Torah portion as well as some other places. We saw not long ago this idea that, you don't reap the corners of your fields. That's for the poor. Furthermore, when you're gathering in your increase, a little bit falls on the ground, you let it go. Because there'll be poor people that will benefit from that. Let me suggest something here. You can eat what grows naturally during the year that are set aside. Is there a common thread? Yeah, it's his land. You have been blessed to possess it, to dwell in it with his conditions. And you know what else? Ultimately, it's his produce that he brings forth with his rain and his seed and those things that he brings forth naturally on his land. Isn't it wonderful that he is willing to let you have the use of that produce? You can eat it. You can be blessed by it. You can have more if you'll walk in obedience than you ever dreamed of, than you need. But ultimately, you got to understand something. It's not your land. It's not your produce. It's his. He writes the rules. And I keep coming back to this. Isn't it better to think that it's his land than to realize that if it's not his land, who owns it? Yeah, the biggest brother you can imagine. He's going to tell you, ha ha, it's my land. Forget that God. He's not welcome here. You will have no other gods before the Almighty State. You cannot serve two masters. You'll love one, you'll hate the other. If we would have trusted in him, all of these blessings would have come upon us. And just as what we've seen happen over and over again in history and in scripture, we're back there again. What people don't understand in America is you don't own the land. You'd like to. Once upon a time, there was this thing called allodium. You can look it up in a law dictionary, allodium. Fee simple absolute. The idea was people could own land. You go back and you look at the common law British history, and you see what it is that in part the colonists were objecting to 50 years ago. It was the idea that the king owned everything, that the sovereign owned the land. Well, they agreed. The sovereign does own the land. We have rights. They come from God, not the king. And all of these things, this whole Torah portion and everything that it literally addresses, just in passing in a lot of cases, the whole concept of the Shemitah, the Yovel, land reverting to who? To the ones that the Creator, who has it, has given it to. We have to keep that attitude in mind. And I really do think that the difference here, the difference between what we see and what we should have seen, is the attitude. Whose land is it anyway? Whose produce is it anyway? If I begin to get the idea, hey, I'm just a sojourner, kind of like Abraham, I'm thankful that he has given me this land, right? This land is mine. God gave this land to me. Well, he did, and he can take it back. And as long as we realize it's his and the produce is his, then we have a whole different attitude with respect to the blessings and the things that he says to do with his land than we do otherwise.